What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Noel. Happy to be with you.
Ron, Happy New Year. I think this is the first time we get to talk this new year, and hope you had a great holiday season. You recently authored an opinion piece about how Americans see Joe Biden after 4 years. Very interesting as it relates to his numbers. Tell us about it.
Well, his job rating as he's leaving office now, as well as his personal rating, each are about 39% on the positive side and in the high 50s on the negative side. And that's not a good rating, certainly, when you have a majority of the American people who both dislike you and disapprove of the job you've done. Now, having said that, we've had other presidents who've left with lower ratings. For example, George Bush left with 34% approval. Jimmy Carter left with 34% approval, and Donald Trump left with 34% approval. So you know, having those numbers like Biden has is nothing unusual. You know, we've seen that before, and we've seen a little worse in his position before. Other presidents, for instance, Ronald Reagan had a 63% approval rating when he left office. Bill Clinton actually had the highest at 66%. And Barack Obama's rating was pretty good. He was rated in the high 50s when he left. When you look at it all, Biden is on the low end of recent presidents. And he's got a majority of the American people who aren't happy with him. And on major issues, it's even worse. His ratings tend to be in the low to mid-30s.
Specifically, 31% on inflation and prices. Surprisingly, 33% on abortion, 34% on taxes and government, 35% on crime, 38% on jobs and the economy, and 39% on climate change. Some of the hallmark cornerstones of his platform that he ran on, he ends up doing miserably by the end of his tenure as president, which is kind of surprising because he actually delivered to those respective constituencies over and over again.
It is surprising, but he didn't deliver as much as they wanted him to deliver. And that's the problem, because when you're a Democratic president, you have a low rating on abortion, a low rating on climate change. That's an indication that, you know, the vast majority of Republicans don't think you did a good job on that issue. A large segment of independents don't think you did a good job on that issue. And even some Democrats don't, because they think you should have gone further and done more.
Ron has been kind of here recently, a little bit on a speaking tour, trying to preserve his legacy. Obviously, he's reading these numbers, and it seems as though he's throwing these Hail Mary passes to try and improve them.
Yeah, I mean, it does look like that. I'm sure, you know, there are things that he still would like to do that he hasn't done. You know, the way his presidency ended up was somewhat unusual, and it was probably very dissatisfying for him and the people around him, because they were expecting a re-election fight that they thought they had a chance to win, and then they thought they had a chance to get a second term, and that he'd have another 4 years to to do the things they wanted to do. But of course, it didn't happen like that. Members of his own party sort of nudged him out of the race. And then he supported, you know, his party's candidate for the position. But I think the whole thing was very unsatisfying for him. And it was not the way he wanted to end his term of office.
The overall, how do you see the Democratic Party actually handling this transition? Do you think they've been kind to Joe Biden or not?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I know a lot of people who are close to Joe Biden and support him think that he was treated horribly. And that extends not only to the people who called for his resignation, but to a lot of the people who worked for and were close to Vice President Harris in her campaign for president. On the other hand, I think, you know, a lot of people recognize, regardless of party, that he sort of brought his situation onto himself. If there were real concerns about his age, and, you know, age concerns like that is not just a concern about, you know, can you do the job now? It's also about can you do the job in 2 or 3 and 4 years? And he's even sort of hinted at that recently. But I think, and wrote about it and talked about it at the time he took office 4 years ago, that he needed to commit to serving one term and then do his best in that one term to get things done and to do it with as little partisan politics as possible. Now, that's not what happened. He geared his whole term to running for re-election. And he did run for re-election. They raised hundreds of millions of dollars, spent a lot of money, campaigned around the country, and nothing they did worked. Nothing they did worked. And one of the things that I point out in the column that you referred to is, you know, he started off his presidency 4 years ago with a 57% approval rating, which is pretty good. And then he lost it in the summer of 2021, and it was really the Afghan pullout that was at the core of it. And between that and concern about he was spending too much money, you might remember he had over a $3 billion so-called infrastructure bill that had everything in it but infrastructure, and also his handling of the pandemic rating on that was going down, and so his rating slipped from, you know, the mid to high 50s to the low 40s over a period of a few months, and Afghanistan was really sort of the center of it because it drove down the image that he had credibility in terms of being competent, and it also drove down his image that he had credibility in the foreign policy field, and he never recovered from that. And you know, we saw 3 years now where he's basically been stuck on the bottom. You know, he still has the support of the bulk of Democrats, but that's about it. And nothing he could do improved the situation, which was the best argument for not running again.
When we, I'm assuming that these polls were taken after the pardon.
Yes, yeah, the polls on Biden were taken after the pardon of his son. And after the 37 commutations of people on death row.
Do you believe that these like numbers are crystallized, or do you think that ultimately there may be some change in this? And have we polled this notion of transparency, honesty, integrity relative to the pardons?
Well, I haven't seen anything specifically on that. I suspect at some point we will. In fact, the next column I'm doing is about pardons, presidential pardons. And I actually think the system is broken and it needs some fixes. But the but I do think that's an issue that's worked against him recently, although I do find that a lot of people who disapprove of the pardons also quickly follow up and say, well, if they were in his position, they would have pardoned their son, too. So it cuts both ways. But I don't think anything has really helped his position since he took himself out of reelection. He's just sort of lagged where he had been. And I think that's where he's going to end up next week when he leaves office.
Yeah. Let's get to a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about the transition to the Republican administration led by President-elect Donald Trump. Your thoughts there. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, as one administration leaves, another administration comes in. They started confirmation hearings today on Pete Hegseth for the Secretary of Defense. I watched about an hour and a half of it before I went on air. There's nothing bipartisan going on at the present time, right?
No, not in these hearings, and I don't think you're going to see it on Hegseth or some of these other more controversial nominations. Now, you could very well see it on nominations for, let's say, Marco Rubio for Secretary of State. I think there'll be Democrats and Republicans joining together to support Rubio. So you may see it on those, but in the three or four more controversial picks, I think you're going to see party line voting for the most part.
Before we get into Donald Trump and what he's done in the interim, interestingly, Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania has really been criticized quite a bit by Democrats for agreeing to meet with Donald Trump and agreeing to meet with some of the his folks that he put up in cabinet positions. And it's really kind of refreshing to hear Fetterman say, you know, like, what are we afraid of? What's the controversy? I mean, you know, if the Senate has advising consent duties, why would anybody be mad at me to meet with those folks so I can fulfill the responsibilities that I have under advising consent? Your thoughts?
Well, I never thought I'd use these words, but Fetterman is right and the Democrats are wrong here. And, you know, most people think of Fetterman as being a pretty hardcore liberal progressive Democrat. But when you really look at him, his voting record sometimes, things that he says, he's an iconoclast. He's very independent minded and doesn't always follow the party orthodoxy. And, you know, we saw that in a number of things recently. For example, he opposed the nomination of his home state's Democratic governor to be on the presidential ticket for the Democrats, and that was something very unusual that you wouldn't often see. But I do think getting to his point, of course, members of both parties should be talking to one another. They should be talking to potential nominees for these positions. They should be working with the other side. And it makes absolutely no sense if they don't. And I think both parties need to get themselves straight on this issue, that you know, the election's over with. There's going to still be big battles over a lot of important issues. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be cooperating and working together if it doesn't require you to surrender your principles. Nobody's saying they should surrender their principles. That's up to them on the right or left. But to make the system work better, to represent the people they were elected by, they need to do that. And I think Fetterman is right.
Yeah. And he's already come out and said that there are a number of these folks that were placed up for consideration by President-elect Donald Trump that he said he's going to support. And that really sent him into a whirlwind.
Sure. Sure, because if Democrats, you know, start supporting some of these nominees, even if there's some Republicans who don't, then that gives the nominees a much better chance to be confirmed. So, years past, most presidential appointments were approved by overwhelming majorities from both parties. But that's changed in recent years, and you're going to see an awful lot of party line voting. But I think what you will see is that the Democrats are going to focus on what they see as the weak points, which would be Hegseth and the director of national intelligence and the FBI director. They'll be focusing on those appointments. And a lot of the other appointments will get through, even though they may have some Democratic support. Most of them will be party line voting.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this ultimately plays itself out, for sure. It was interesting. Well, and go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think ultimately, whether he loses a couple of nominees or not, I think it's going to play out in Trump's favor. He's going to get what he wants, essentially. And even though he might have to, he's already sacrificed an attorney general nominee, maybe he has to sacrifice another one along the way. But basically, he's going to get pretty much what he wants.
Yeah. Hey, and for those that are wondering, it only requires a majority vote in the Senate, right? You got to come out of
right.
the committee with a majority vote, and then the only way you get to the Senate floor is to come out of that committee. Hegseth is before the Armed Forces Committee. You know, it was interesting, and I had him on the show the other day, Troy Carter. We have Troy Carter and my mind just went blank on the other congressperson, Democratic congressperson.
Cleo Fields,
thank you.
Yeah.
Cleo Fields. And we have Mike Johnson up for the Speaker of the House. And I asked him the question, can you part with your party and do what's in the best interest of the state of Louisiana? We couldn't have choreographed the situation that we have now where we hold the two top positions in the House of Representatives with two representatives, Republican representatives from the state of Louisiana. And he said, no. And it was like, well, you don't think your guy's going to win, right? Hakeem Jeffries. And his ideology certainly doesn't align with Louisiana. And then, the interesting thing, immediately after, the first ballot and Mike Johnson gets elected to the Speaker of the House, Hakeem Jeffries walks up to the podium and starts talking about bipartisanship. It's like,
right,
what?
Right.
I mean,
well, everybody wants
like,
bipartisanship.
You must think we're stupid.
Everybody wants bipartisanship when it's their bill they're voting on. They want everybody to vote for it. But they want to, they're going to be in terrible blood-curdling battle on everything else, and that's where it is now. There were times past where members of Louisiana congressional delegation, and I'm not picking on Troy Carter, he's been a friend of mine for many, many years.
No, me too. I've supported him every time he's run.
Sure. But that is the point of view, and it's also the point of view of the Republicans. I didn't see any Democrats who voted for Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker, so both sides are doing it, but I do think that the days of people really putting their state above partisanship is rapidly diminishing. Now, having said that, I do think the Louisiana delegation on a lot of issues has worked and continues to work on a more bipartisan basis than other states have. But let's hope that doesn't, what's left of that doesn't completely run out.
No, exactly. I mean, it's just a little frustrating, because we keep talking about bipartisan, this bipartisan, that bipartisan. And it's like every time you have the opportunity where actions speak louder than words, we don't take action.
Right. It's not about whether issues are right or wrong. It's about whether we can hurt the other side. And if one side doesn't think they can hurt the other side, then they'll fold and they'll work with them. But if they think they can get some political capital out of it, they're gonna punch them as hard as they can and not stop, even though they very well could have reached a compromise solution on the problem. You know, I've always thought this, and I find most people around the country agree with this. The people who don't agree with this are people in Washington, and when you talk like this in Washington, they look at you like you're an alien from outer space. But some of the toughest issues we have on taxes and immigration and the border security and defense matters and just a whole range of things actually could be worked out if you built coalitions from the center out, where you got Republicans and Democrats who are willing to work together to come up with sensible approaches. And sure, they might be, 20-30% of the Republican caucus won't go along with it, or 20-30% of the Democratic caucus that won't go along with it. But there'll be, 70% in the middle, 60-70% of the middle who'll support it. So that is sort of lost right now in the Congress. And I have to say, it's one of the things that I have been particularly impressed with Speaker Mike Johnson on is that, look, he's a solid conservative. Nobody would ever question his conservative credentials. But he has acted like a gentleman. He's acted with civility. And he's been very smart politically in terms of working with both sides and also trying to bring in people in his own party who may disagree to come up with solutions they can all sign on to. And I think he's done a very good job with that.
Yeah. So let's talk about President-elect Donald Trump's temperament in this lame duck period. I mean, there's been examples of, I think, him handling things very appropriately. And then again, every now and again, off the rails.
Well, Donald Trump is a disruptor, and he's always going to be. So we always have to expect that. But I think where he is now is a lot different than where he was 8 years ago when he took office. 8 years ago, there was a lot of chaos. He was a business person who hadn't been in public office before. There was just an awful lot of things he didn't know how to do. Or understand the powers of the office, or understand how to deal with Congress. But I think over the last 8 years, he's learned a lot of lessons. And I think he's calmer. I think he's cooler. I think he is using more sophisticated strategies now to get things done. And so I see a big change over where he was in 8 years. Now, will that all fall apart at a certain point? I don't know. But he's got two congressional leaders and Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, who are very capable legislators and are going to give Trump good advice on what he can and can't do. And if he listens to them and with his chief of staff, who seems to be doing an excellent job sort of holding the organization together, having those people around him, I think, will be a big help.
Susan Wiles is an interesting individual, right?
She sure is. And she seems to be one of the few people who can organize Trump, sort of keep him on a path that makes sense and gets things done and sort of filters out a lot of the people who will try to distract from, the central mission of what the administration's supposed to be doing. And of course, it takes Donald Trump to agree to that. He's the one who put her in this position. But I think that right there speaks very well of her. And I think it also shows how things are different than they were 8 years ago. And, for the country's sake, let's hope she can hold that together.
Well, one thing for certain, this confirmation process will test the resiliency of this administration even before it takes office.
Sure. And it always does. And because there's usually, you know, a couple of appointments that are potential problems. In years past, those appointees generally pulled out to avoid the bloodletting. But in this particular case, outside of Matt Gaetz, who pulled out of the attorney general's position, and I don't think ultimately he could have been confirmed. But no. But I think where they are now is the Republican leadership in the Senate are going to sit down and say, okay, we've got three or four appointees that have problems. You know, let's get the people in here who have problems with them, and let's say, you know, well, go ahead and vote against maybe Kennedy and Gabbard, but we need you to vote for, you know, Hegseth and Ash Patel, for example, or vice versa, where some of these senators who aren't happy with the appointments have an opportunity to vote against one or two or three of them, but they're still going to vote for one or two of them when their votes are needed. So I think you're going to see a lot of that happening, and that will be very helpful in pushing some of these people over the top. Another thing you have to remember, some years ago, we saw more of this, but there's a lot of members of Congress who basically think that presidents should have the right to have the staff and the cabinet that he wants. And unless somebody is completely unqualified or unsuited and unfit for the office, you know, the practice has often been, well, we'll give the president what we want, what he wants, even though it's not exactly what we want. And I think, you know, there is still some of that, and you're going to see that play out on the less controversial nominations. But of course, now everything is a political fight. And a lot of people ask me in speeches, well, why is it all a political fight, particularly if it's not helping them? And the answer is one word, money. Both sides raise a lot of money on these battles. I can promise you Democrats are raising a lot of money on Pete Hegseth and on Kash Patel and on these other controversial nominations, just like the Republicans were raising money, you know, trying to impeach Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security and attacking Nancy Pelosi and whatever else it may have been. So a lot of it has to do with stirring up fights that are unproductive for the country and also politically unproductive for both sides, just to raise money. And we can't forget that.
If you had to pick the three nominees that you think are going to have the most difficult path to confirmation, who would they be?
Well, it probably would be Hegseth, Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard, and probably Robert Kennedy would be in that list too. Although I think it's possible that Kennedy will get some or more Democratic votes than some people think is might happen. And so I'm inclined to think, I mean, I would bet that all of them right now would have a slightly better than 50-50 shot of being confirmed. Now, it's very possible some new issue will blow up in one of their faces in these confirmation hearings. It's easy for somebody to screw up, say something wrong, open up a Pandora's box of problems and attacks. So that can always happen, and that would change things. But as it stands now, I think Trump has a shot to get all of them confirmed.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of these folks are experts in many respects in their own right, but they don't come, they're not a product of the bureaucracy. And that seems to be a big problem for a number of Democrats, separate and apart from the letter behind their name, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it is a conundrum. You know, on the one hand, you know, I'm somebody who tends to be more of a change agent. I think government needs to be shaken up periodically. It needs to be changed, reorganized, overhauled, cleaned out. And but so you want people who have the instinct and the ability to do that. But oftentimes it takes people who have experience in those departments or experience working within government to know how to get that done effectively. So that's always a difficult thing. But ultimately, a lot of it depends on the president. You know, if a department head has the president's support on doing an agenda to reform a department, to overhaul it, to clean it up, then it can go a long ways and accomplish a lot of things. So we'll see what happens here. But there's a lot of things that have to happen, a lot of issues that have to come before us. And as we've seen in politics over the years, you know, what looks like something going in one direction can turn around on a dime and quickly move in the opposite way.
When we come back, Ron, I want to talk about the complexities of the fact that what is definitive is that the president can only serve one term and what that means in your experience. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. There is a unique phenomenon to what's going on right now. I think this is the first time in decades, long, long time, that we have one term served by a president, an interruption, and then he comes back. The president can only serve this one term. If you would, Ron, I mean, the complexities of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I thought, and I was in a distinct minority, thought that Joe Biden should have announced, as we discussed earlier, that he wasn't running for re-election. And of course, everybody said, oh, he can't do that, then he'll be a lame duck. And I said, well, so what if he's a lame duck? He's still going to have the support of members of his Congress. And being a lame duck, all it does really is it cools down the political battling, the partisanship involved. So anyway, he didn't do it, and that's where he was, even though he didn't want to be a lame duck. Well, Donald Trump is a lame duck, but he doesn't seem like it right now. You know, the members of his party are unified around him. The opposition is terrified of everything he's going to do. So he's operating as somebody who appears to be on the scene for a long time, whether he's president or not. So the idea of a lame duck, I think, has changed some over time as the partisanship has tended to harden. You know, as it stands now, you know, all the Republicans who want to run for president are going to be vying for Donald Trump's support and help. Well, that doesn't seem like much of a lame duck. You know, that's sort of like having the benefit of incumbency. So we'll see how he manages that. Now, look, if his popularity, which is never particularly high, he always has high negatives. But if his popularity goes down even worse and he becomes a real albatross around the necks of Republicans who are running in the 2026 elections, then that becomes a problem. But it's not so much because of lame duck. It's just because he reaches a point of low popularity that Republicans don't want to be tied to.
So next Monday is the date of inauguration. The Republicans are talking about expedited confirmation hearings. They're hoping that some may be ready for that confirmation on the 20th. Do you think that actually happens? I don't think the Democrats have actually played their last card on this confirmation issue. And when you have so many days that you're in office, every day that they're able to delay is a win. in their view. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And a lot of it is, you know, everybody is sort of setting their markers and they're feeling around for the soft spots in the opposition. And if one of these confirmations or a couple of these confirmations start proving to me more difficult than they may look today, then the Democrats want to keep that going. They want to keep that fight. They want to keep messaging the fact that, you know, somebody is unqualified or somebody has wacky ideas or whatever it may be. So they're, you know, the Democrats have no interest in moving most things quickly, whereas the Republicans now do. That's why Trump and Mike Johnson are trying to put everything together in one reconciliation bill so they can have budget issues and immigration issues and defense issues all wrapped up that they could move at one time. So there's a lot of timing issues involved, but ultimately, you know, the parties that control both houses of Congress are going to call those shots.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. This is going to be a very interesting time in the coming days, right? And I know that they're looking to move forward with speed. I know that they talked about how fast they actually confirmed Obama's appointees, and I was kind of surprised that it was as quick. I can't remember the amount of days. You may have seen that article that was posted.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know if you were surprised, but I was kind of surprised that they moved as quickly as they did, which means that they had Republican support for some of these individuals.
Sure.
So Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see whether or not that happens on any of these this time. I mean, you think that it well may be.
And one more thing to consider with the lame duck is that that means that both parties have an open shot for president next time. And there's an awful lot of members of Congress, particularly senators, who are going to want to run for president. So the dynamic of having all of these presidential candidates in the cabinet, as well as in the Senate on the Republican side, and in the Senate, and particularly among Democrats who are governors on the other side, that's going to have a big impact on the political dynamics as well.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ron Fauché, political analyst, publisher of Lunchtime Politics. As always, we enjoyed the conversation. Have a great week. Oh, we may have lost him. We'll be right back, folks. Ian Hoke is in for Scoot. Stay with us. Folks, we covered a lot of territory today, and I hope you enjoyed topics. The conversation with David and Sarah, fellow for Free Expression and Technology, who actually worked for Meta, and we had an inside perspective of actually what was going there was very interesting, to say the least. And Ian Hoke joins us. He's in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Good afternoon, Sheriff. We're going to ask, is social media even useful during emergencies anymore? We're going to talk to a journalist and former reporter for the Los Angeles Times about his experience covering that fire as a civilian instead of a reporter. And we're going to talk to the Southern Rail Commission chairman, Knox Ross, in the 3 o'clock hour about a passenger rail service between New Orleans and Mobile. They just got a $20 million boost. Very excited about that. It's going to be a great one, Sheriff. Thank you.
All righty. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. We'll see you in the morning.